well, why am I working so hard? Is this really the way it's supposed to be? And am I really supposed to be struggling and failing? Yes, everyone fails. And it's an amazing and essential part of success.
Welcome to Energy Matters, exploring awakening to your authentic self and finding purpose through mind, body, and soul. With your hosts, Cody Edner and David Gandelman. Brought to you by intuitivevision.net and groundedmind.com.
Welcome to another episode of Energy Matters. And as always, I am here with my good friend and co-host, David Gandelman. Hey, David.
I've been spending a lot of time with you, Cody.
That's right. We are freshly back from our retreat in Costa Rica, which I could not have hoped for anything better. It really exceeded all of my expectations on so many different levels. There was great sun, great fun.
Are you
fun.
Putting enough aloe on your bum?
Yeah, exactly. And
here, let me give you a hand.
Yeah. I don't think so. And it was so deeply transformative. That was the thing that was just so, just blew my mind, was how much the group really shifted their energy and went, you know, through huge steps of awareness and growth. It was great fun. So.
Yeah, it was. It was a very special trip. It's weird being back in America.
It is. It was a little bit of an adjustment coming back.
I went out to dinner the other night and I just could not. I kept saying gracias every time someone brought something to the table. And I was with my grandparents and they speak Russian. So I was speaking Russian with them. And then the waitress spoke Russian. She's speaking Russian and I'm answering in Spanish. I was like, oh my God, I need help. And since we need help, we've got a specialist on today with that.
We do. This is a pretty exciting topic that we get to talk to and explore today with Dan Lerner, who is a pretty prominent speaker, author, and coach. And really, I think one of the things that stands out to me about him is that he teaches really one of the biggest courses at NYU. And by biggest, I mean most attended, right? They have like 500 plus students a semester. And it is a course that explores, of course, happiness and kind of rooted in the study of positive psychology, which has really been growing over the last decade or so across the country. So I'm excited to get to sit down and chat with Dan and talk a little bit about his book, Thrive You, How to Succeed at College. And of course, my interest, I'm a little biased here, but my interest is because my daughter is coming up on college age. And any tips and help on how to help her have a successful journey through college is definitely something I'm interested in right now.
Yeah, we talk about that. And maybe me and you should go back to college and do like one of those old, like an old school kind of, you know, that movie.
That would be fun.
Will Ferrell. Maybe we should start an Energy Matters fraternity.
Yeah, start our own energy fraternity. Go to college, gain some energy awareness.
Haze you. We'll haze you by making you sit still in the corner and meditate all day.
Meditate for 8 hours, yeah.
Right when I said that, my Siri turned on and said, and wrote it all out. Siri just wrote out, we'll haze you by making you sit still in the corner.
Oh, that's funny.
Whoa. That was interesting. actually, I went to... When I was at Cornell University with my cousin once who went there, he showed me his old fraternity and we went into the fraternity house and they were giving us a tour. And as they were giving us a tour, there was a room and it said boiler room on there. And the guy looks at it while he's giving us a tour. He goes, oh, crap, I forgot. And he opens the door and there's this poor kid sitting on a stool next to the boiler listening to the ice cream truck song like over and over. And he had been in there for 2 hours being hazed. and he's like, oh, you can come
so
out
bad.
Now. Yeah, so maybe Dan Lerner today can help us with going back to school.
Yeah, we need to do like hazing for happiness and success rather than...
Hazing for happiness. Dan's second book will be Hazing for Happiness.
Yeah, that's a great title.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's jump into it. And before we do, energymatterspodcast.com. If you guys want to get on our newsletter and get all the new episodes, we always send them out. And then we'll let you know when we're traveling to a foreign country again and invite you next time.
For sure.
Yeah. All right. Let's jump into it. Dan Lerner. Hey, Energy Matters listeners, welcome back to another awesome episode. We've got an incredible guest with us today, instructor, speaker, and author Dan Lerner. I've been excited just talking to him before the show started. He's full of enthusiasm and funnier than Cody and I are, so we're going to have a good time. Welcome, Dan.
That's too high of a bar to live up to. I'm sorry. Let's start again. But I'll try to be as funny as you guys. Thank you for having me on the show. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. And Cody and I have been, you know, watching your YouTube videos and checking out your book, which is You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and Life, which is a very pertinent topic for Cody right now because his daughter is going to be applying to colleges soon. So we'll jump into that. One of the most interesting things that I found out about you is that you teach this class at NYU called The Science of Happiness. And I was actually watching a YouTube video when you were teaching it. It's fascinating. Isn't it the most attended elective class at NYU? I think I saw something about that.
It is. It's the most popular elective class at NYU. We have about 500 students a semester. Same classroom, 500 of them, about 1,000 students a year. And we have a great time. I can't speak for the students, but, you know, the Alan Schrechter, who I teach with, he and I have a wonderful time. So it's been a really remarkable bunch of years sharing science of happiness with these students, you know, and I don't want to scare anybody who might be either listening or potentially interviewing here who might have a kid who's heading off to college soon. But college students it's a tough time, right? We think it's going to be the four best years of our life. And for a lot of us who went to college 10, 20, even longer ago, you know, it was an amazing 4 years for some of us, 5 years. But, today, it's really interesting because you look at the stats and, like, you know, Gallup poll 2015, 90% of students have said they felt overwhelming stress on campus. 60% have said they felt very sad on campus in the past year. 45% have said that they have felt that things were hopeless. And 40% in a poll just that came out a few weeks ago, 40% have said they felt that they've dealt with work debilitating depression on campus. So you're like, whoa, this is not what we expected, right? And so the science of happiness, we do a couple of things. A, we talk about what it means to be happy or have well-being with positive emotion and relationships and meaning and purpose and passion, all those things that are essential to well-being. But also we address the other side. So what does it look like to be stressed out? What is anxiety? What is depression? And the fellow I teach with, my great buddy and co-author, Alan Schlechter, he's an adolescent psychiatrist. So he comes at it from a very practical perspective. So we really want to bring both sides of the students. Look, you are going to be stressed out. You are probably going to feel sad. There's a good chance you're going to be depressed. Here's how to recognize it. Here's what to do. And here are the amazing opportunities you have also to raise your levels of well-being, happiness, so on and so forth. So it's a real pleasure to help out thousands of students a year really make the most of their college experience.
Wow.
That's incredible.
So Dan, and all those stats, like, what is it that is going on that's different than 20 years ago? I mean, is it more pressure, more competition, you know, have to do with the future and what they see ahead? Like, is there an understanding of why we find ourselves in this situation, especially in those 4 or 5 years that should be really an exciting time of growth and discovery and development and, you know, coming of age, really? And I'm just curious, like, what in the world is going on?
You know, I think A, it's a great question. B, we could actually talk for the next 3 hours about just that question. Because there's so many factors that are coming into play. And we can certainly talk about a couple of them. I won't even say first and foremost. I'll just say there are a number of them that come into play. You know, one that might be most obvious in our face is going to be the idea of social media, right? So let's look at Instagram and anything and any other social media platform that I am too old to be aware of, Snapchat, those kind of things. Everyone's happy all the time. No one posts themselves being unhappy. So, like, there's this level of, oh, well, clearly everyone's, like, super happy right now. If I'm not, then there's something wrong with me, right? And look, and by the way, one of the first questions we ask in our class, first day of class, is who here's been stressed out since they got to college? every single hand goes up. And so I'm like, oh, keep them up, keep them up. Look around. And you see the eyes widen. And they're like, oh my gosh, I thought I was the only one. And you're like, no, no, no. You're not the only one. In fact, everyone is part of this party that you don't want to be a part of. So I think they're so used to seeing people happy, and all of a sudden they're like, whoa, okay, wait a second. That's not necessarily the case. But, you know, the thing that we discuss in class quite a bit is, I think, really unrealistic expectations on an even larger scale. What I'll say to the students is that Mark Zuckerberg and Taylor Swift kind of ruined your life. Right. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a huge fan of both of them. But what we tend to do is we tend to forget about how hard people have worked and how long it's taken them to get to a certain place. And so the measurement that we have for success seems to be changing constantly and getting increasingly unrealistic. So, you know, when I graduated from school, you know, back in 93, and I know it's ages ago, but back in 93, I remember a buddy of mine right in the edge of the tech bubble saying, I'm going to make $1 million by the time I'm 30. And I was like, oh, man. $1 million by the time you're 30. That's crazy. Like, I may never see that money in my entire life. And then it went to like 25 years old. And then it went to like 22 years old. And now for a lot of my students, they're like, if I'm not successful right out of school, if I don't have a successful business, like practically before I graduate and make $1 million,
I'm 4 years old.
That's right. That's exactly it. My parents clearly failed me because I'm in college and I shouldn't be. I should be living on a yacht somewhere having invested in Bitcoin 9 months ago.
Right.
What's wrong with my parents, right? So, but we set up these expectations. And if you, I think you set that next to the idea of American Idol, and you set it next to So You Think You Can Dance and all these other shows that basically show instant success, you have an issue. Because when it comes to those shows, none of those people had instant success. Adam Lambert was working his tail off for years before he got to American Idol. Right. Every single person who made it on So You Think You Can Dance has been working for years. Mark Zuckerberg was programming since middle school. Taylor Swift picked up her first guitar when she was like 7. So it wasn't like they were like, oh, look at me, I'm super famous all of a sudden 24 hours later. But we don't talk about the hard work. And because we don't talk about it, I think a lot of the kids are like, well, why am I working so hard? Is this really the way it's supposed to be? And am I really supposed to be struggling and failing? Yes, everyone fails. And it's an amazing and essential part of success. So yeah. A, everyone's happy, but they're not. And B, everyone's getting success, but they don't. And then students start putting stress on themselves to be the best, the happiest, the most successful in a really unrealistic way. And that's a super dangerous trap.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's really interesting because when we look at like athletics, we have that kind of subconsciously, we really know how hard someone worked so we can appreciate them at the top of their game. And, you know, I don't think I could go out and do that, right? Watching the Olympics or something. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to something like being a musician or being an entrepreneur, we tend to not, we just see that success and think, oh, it just happened to them somehow. It should be that easy.
That's, I agree with you 100%. And yes, one could argue, particularly when we talk on music and sport, that it's basically the same process.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they have practiced for the same amount of hours. Those people who are successful have figured out a way to deal with stress because they're going to be performing in front of an audience. Like, you know, and I would argue this, it's the same thing almost across the board when it comes to being great. It's the same process.
Right.
When it comes to dealing with stress mentally, it's a similar process. And so, like you said, it's apparent in some cases and totally not apparent in others. What I would suggest to folks is that they read stories and they really dig in and get a sense of what the pathways really were for people rather than assuming that they know. And look, if you look at studies, for example, Carol Dweck, a psychologist who's looked at mindset. So one example is when you take a group of fifth graders and you tell them stories about Thomas Edison, Helen Keller, Albert Einstein. And with one group of fifth graders, you read them stories that basically say, oh, they were always brilliant and talented, so they were bound to succeed. And the other group of fifth graders, you read them stories that said, Edison failed over and over and over and over and over. And Einstein failed over and over and over and worked incredibly hard. And Keller worked and worked and worked and worked and worked. When you ask the fifth graders afterwards if they want to take a class that's harder or easier, the ones who were read the, oh, they're clearly naturally talented stories, they'll choose the easier class. But the fifth graders who were read the, they worked really hard and it was really challenging and they failed and they picked themselves up, they're far more likely to take a more challenging class. And they're also more likely to ask for help, right? So simply knowing the background of these folks, I think is key because it gives students and all of us a realistic understanding of what the pathway is.
I'm a ferocious reader of biographies. I don't know about you guys, but I love reading biographies like Benjamin Franklin and Einstein was one that I read that totally changed my life. And I love diving deep into the stories of some of these really successful people, Nikola Tesla, and just seeing what the kind of the arc of their life path and how they overcame so much. And it's almost always the same kind of stories that in some form or another, they overcame a massive amount of invalidation or failure and work through it. And that turned them into who they are, like Tony Robbins, for example. And that's, like you were saying, not the story we always get to see. Dan, I've heard you mention you want to go for happiness before success. And a lot of people go for success before happiness. Can you explain a little bit about what you mean when you say that?
Sure. First of all, let me just say the image of a ferocious reader is something I love because I have this image of you like, just like gritting your teeth and like practically, you know, eating the pages, which is fantastic. And by the way, you're like a super aggressive, like alpha nerd. Which is so cool.
I want to know everything about Thomas Edison right now. Damn it.
Right now, mom.
The meatloaf.
That's right. The meatloaf. Ah!
Mom, reading the meatloaf.
You know, one of the things, as an aside before I jump into that question, is, you know, one of the most, and I have a 10-year-old boy, so I come at this from a biased perspective, but I think one of the most fascinating opportunities that we've seen recently for biographies to affect people was Hamilton. Because I started the Hamilton biography about 6 years ago, and I'm just up to the part where George Washington dies. Spoiler alert, I'm sorry, it happens. But for my kiddo, when Hamilton came out as a musical, and you really got to see how hard it was, what he struggled through, like what he had to overcome to get to where he was, it was like, yes. And now, you know, my kid and a whole host of other kids and the generation know, oh, this is Alexander Hamilton. How fascinating is that? So, you know, it's really changed the way I think that they understand what success, or at least it helps to impact the way they understand success. Now, when it comes to success and happiness and the way in which they relate to one another, yes. And I'm certainly not the first one to say it, but it with my background in performance, it struck a particularly deep chord with me in that we tend to think that success is going to come first in our culture. And if you look at traditional measurements of success, income, house, car, position, right? We can see that they actually don't tend to bring us happiness. It's sort of like living on a treadmill. You get that job you always wanted, amazing, for a little while, and then you want a promotion. You get the salary that's kind of mind-blowing to you, amazing, and then you actually want a raise, right? You get the house you've always dreamed about, fantastic, and that doesn't feel as good anymore. Or the car, or the partner, or whatever it is. You know, so success might lead to a bit of happiness, a fleeting happiness. It doesn't tend to be all that enduring. When I say that happiness can lead to greater success, what I'm really referring to is the science around positive emotion that we've been looking closely at for the last 25 years or so. And that's the idea of what happens to us when we are primed with positive emotions. If I ask you guys or anyone out there to spend the next 30 seconds thinking of the happiest possible memory you can, well, that's nice and everything. But if I tell you that doing exactly that has led to college students scoring better on their SATs and other tests of that sort. If I tell you that that's led to doctors diagnosing symptoms up to 20% more quickly, if I tell you that that has led 45 seconds of positive emotion priming, has led high school students to retain 35% more words in a foreign language or to be 75% more creative, it's actually kind of amazing. And so everything I've just referenced is easily accessible and really solid research. And that's why I say that it can actually lead to higher levels of success, because we're seeing it in the labs with students, with adults. We're starting to see it in graduate programs, Stanford, NYU, University of Pennsylvania. All the business programs have something related to positive emotion and positive business. And if you look at businesses like Google or Yahoo or Patagonia, they do things, whether it's pool tables or surfboards that they line their halls with to encourage their people to go surfing. They do things that help raise levels of positive emotion. not just because they want the people to be happy, because they know the bottom line is that the people be more productive. And finally, I'll take a step even further away from kind of our day-to-day lives and talk about some folks who we can easily compare and contrast. It's not as scientific, but you can look at folks who have been successful, who are unhappy, Steve Jobs, for example, not particularly happy, right? Super mm-hmm. successful. And then you can look at someone like Richard Branson, super successful and has always said happiness is an essential part of my being successful, my relationships, my families. You can look at, in sport, someone like Bobby Knight, who won 3 national championships, University of Indiana men's basketball team, but was notoriously abusive and was finally fired for choking one of his own players. He did really well. He also wrote a book called The Power of Negative Thinking. But then you have someone like Mike Krzyzewski, you know? Yeah, I know, right? Exactly. This is not, with all due respect to Coach Knight, it's not who I want to put my kid with. Right, but then right. you have Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, and he's always talked about how important it is for his players to be positive and for them to be relaxed, practice and games, for them to be their best. He's a guy who's won 5 national championships and 3 gold medals as head coach, men's basketball team in Olympics. So, you know, you can look at success from both sides, but the argument for there being a place for positive emotions or positive relationships or meaning and a number of other factors is increasingly evident as we open our minds to the idea that it is out there. We just need to look for it.
Mm-hmm. As you talk about that, Dan, it seems like the people that were like intense and negative to get to success, the focus is on the success. And the people who can approach it with a positive perspective, there's an appreciation for the journey, which kind of stands out to me, that idea in what David was just talking about of loving biographies. Like we're fascinated by the story behind the success, but it doesn't seem like in our culture today, there's a lot of emphasis and validation on enjoying the journey, or maybe that's starting to happen. I mean, meditation and kind of coming back to oneself, I think, is all about learning to reconnect in a day-to-day sense with the journey and kind of enjoy it. But, you know, happiness seems like it comes best, to me at least, is sustainable when we can find that mindset where we can enjoy the journey and the process and not be so fixated on success. But how do we balance that with a drive for success?
Another great question. And I'd almost start with the last part of the question, which how do you balance it with the drive for success? I would argue that it starts with asking the question of how do you define success? Mm-hmm. So are you defining success as the car, house, partner, salary, business card that has some famous organization on it? Or are you defining success as your day-to-day, as doing something that you enjoy doing? You define success as making $10 million. You define success as really making enough money that you can be happy and feel secure and get what you want to get done. You know, are you defining success, in a way that involves the journey or one that only involves the end game? And I think that's really your launching off point. I found that when people sit back, they take a second, they take a moment, they take an hour, they take a day, they take time consistently throughout their life on a regular basis to ask themselves, how am I defining success? Then they're far more likely to end up defining that as the journey itself, or at least a greater percentage as the journey itself. So, you know, are we seeing more of that? That's a really good question. Is the push towards mindfulness helping that? It could well be. But I would argue by all means that if we're really talking about folks being happy, folks being and being successful, that it really is part of the process. Now, if we look at studies, the field of study on passion, for example, one of my favorite areas of research, what we find is that, Robert Valorand at University of Montreal has really defined it as 2 different pathways to passion. One is harmonious passion, which, as it sounds like, is a passion for something that fits in well with your life, the rest of your life. Mm. And the other is an obsessive passion, and you can guess what that means. But part of the descriptors there are that with harmonious passion, you do it because you love it. You do it for the sake of the activity itself. You do it because you look forward to doing it when you get up in the morning. You look forward to losing yourself in it, to working hard at it, as opposed to the obsessive passion where it's really about winning. It's about winning, doing it for other people. It's about winning, doing it for status, winning, doing it for the money. And the research he's done, ranging from Olympic level cyclists, yoga practitioners, ballet dancers, academics, you name it, is really consistent. To your point, it's about doing something that you love the process on rather than the outcome. Now, I'll give you one last thought because it's very fresh in my head. I happened to watch it last night. I was watching the 2002 documentary, Comedian, right, by Jerry Seinfeld.
I saw that.
Oh, good.
Oh, you know, it's really, really good. I got to say, it's surprisingly good. And it speaks to exactly this. He's having a conversation. It kind of tracks him and it tracks another comedian who's up and coming. And Orly Adams, I think is his name. And there's one scene where Adams is basically saying, you know, like, it's really tough because, you know, like, when am I going to make the money? And when am I going to finally sort of get famous? And, you know, all these kind of things. And Seinfeld's looking at him backstage incredulously. He's like, Ben, that's not why we do this. Like, we don't do this for approval. And we don't do it for money. We don't do it for fame. Like, that's the wrong reason. You do it because you love it. And that is at the basis of harmonious passion. It's also the basis of what you're pointing out, which is staying in the moment and doing things that you genuinely enjoy. Now, you might work really hard. It might be tough. You might fall on your face, but it's okay. You still want to keep doing it because it's something you love.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love Jerry Seinfeld. I actually read out Jerry Seinfeld jokes before I start a meditation class just to kind of prime everybody.
Really?
Yeah. He's very nice.
Do you do it with like the whole pacing? You're like, hey, whoa!
Hey, why did you tie your shoes? And that's some basic. I do the Jewish grandpa voice pretty good, but not the Jerry Seinfeld voice. But I actually, in terms of biographies, I do like read up on Jerry Seinfeld, and he has a great piece in the New York Times. It's a video piece of how he writes his jokes and a lot about his biography and how he did comedy. And he, to this day, uses a yellow notepad, and he writes out, in using the same pens he's been using forever, these jokes. And so one joke that has five words in it, he'll spend 2 years on moving the words around. And he'll go to different comedy clubs, just changing the words a little bit, practicing until he perfects it. He's almost like he's an artist, like a really serious artist in that way. And people don't realize because it just sounds like he's making a joke. But he's worked on that thing for years to put each word in the right place. And he says, they asked him, what's your favorite joke of all time? And I heard him say, the worst moment of an adult human being's life is when the toilet is about to overflow. I'm like, that is so freaking true. But he probably worked on that joke for years just to get it just right. And he's always definitely been a model for me in that way. And it takes so much freaking work. I have a friend who just won the Olympics gold medal in hockey for Russia, and he started playing when he was 2 years old. But going back to your point earlier about being relaxed and calm versus like stressed and always needing success, he was always very relaxed and calm about it, just a fierce, hard worker, and it was his art. And I find that so many people these days, which you guys have both already mentioned, but they just want the success right away. They don't realize all of the work it takes. So if you're listening now, and if you're Cody's daughter and you want to go to college, it's going to take a lot of work. Dan, tell
us. Don't pressure yourself too much about that. It's okay.
You better go, girl. We're watching. We're going to check in next year. Want to see where you're at. Dan, I wanted to ask you, how do you become a motivational speaker? How do you become somebody who teaches the science of happiness at NYU? Where did this come from? Did you always have it as a kid, or did you just fall into this path? Can you tell us a bit about your story?
So I've had a very non-traditional path to where I am right now. You know, I grew up in a household with two very successful musicians as parents, classical musicians as parents. So I grew up really loving music. And I played the cello growing up and thought that might be a path that I would take professionally. Oh, wow. And, you know, it was like my freshman year in college. I called my dad. I said, I think I want to do this for a living. And he was just thrilled. You know, he had been in the Pittsburgh Symphony for 45 years. It was his dream for me to be a musician. And he said, great, we will do for you what my parents did for me. You know, you come home at the end of this year and you spend the next year here at home and you practice every day in your room from 9 to 5 with lunch break. And then you go and audition for conservatories. And I was like, wow, that sounds horrible. There's no way I'm doing that. So what else could I do? But I knew I wanted to be in music. So I looked at every internship I could in the music business, in classical music. So I worked Santa Fe Opera, fundraising and development. And I worked for agents and I worked for music festivals, stage managing. And finally, I was like, you know what? This agent thing is fascinating. Like the idea that you get to help other people be the very best they can. That's cool. So I took that job and I spent 10 years in that business. I spent 10 years as a talent agent, some of it as an assistant, but then as a talent agent for some really large companies, representing mostly young opera singers. And, you know, it was during that time where I started really noticing there was a pretty clear divide for people who were in the business, in that they were all successful. At least, you know, the folks we were representing at our company, you know, were all successful. They were singing around the world. They were making really good livings. They were top of their game, top 1%. And yet only some of them were happy. And many of them were not happy. And I was really curious about that. Why does it matter? And what happened? Right? How can you not be happy when you're successful like this? So that's when I left after about a decade in the business. And I thought, I need to understand, where does happiness and success coexist? That was my big question. So first I went to study performance psychology. How do we achieve that level of performance anyway, from a psychological perspective? But that wasn't enough. I really wanted to understand the role of well-being, the role of happiness. So I went back to school and did my graduate work in positive psychology at University of Pennsylvania with the legendary Martin Seligman, amazing, amazing mentor and human being, the father of positive psych. And I really explored that question. Where's the role of well-being in success and expert development? So that's what I've been curious about for a long, long time. Now, I mean, for many years, I would hear from people, they would joke, like I bartended my way through grad school and they were like, all right, Tony Robbins, when are you going to play the garden? And I was like, guys, that's not my path. Like, I totally appreciate him and what he does for the people, but it's really important to me that I'm able to really understand the science and the research behind it, and that I can bring the science and the research to the audience, to the students, to the one-to-one listener. That was too important to me. So in a way, I guess I've always sort of had the get out there and talk to people and get them motivated thing. Mm-hmm. But I really need to have the science go along with it. So once I finished Penn, I was super lucky, like a long story short, to be introduced to the fellow who is now my co-teacher, co-author of You Thrive, and really one of my best friends in the world, Alan Schlechter, Dr. Alan Schlechter. And he invited me to come teach the course with him. He had been teaching it for about a year and a half, 2 years at that point. And we really tore it up and tore the syllabus up and rebuilt it. And that's how we got to teaching the class. And I guess to say, it's such a blessing to be able to, A, teach with someone, and B, teach with someone that you really love. Because it's a constant process of learning for both of us, and also for the classroom, for the students, because he knows extraordinary things as an adolescent, as a psychiatrist, that I don't know. I'm learning from him every day. And I know things, being an expert in positive psychology, that he doesn't know. And so we get to share that with each other and share it with the class. Now, when it comes to speaking, I just refer back to what you said before about Seinfeld. You know, I was giving a talk to a group of speaking agents a few years ago, my own agency. And at the end, they asked me a question. They said, so what is your art form? Because you're so fascinated by artists and performance. And I hadn't thought about it. And I stood there for a second and I went, it's this. Mm-hmm. So speaking to me is sort of like, I put the cello down when I finished college. And I always thought, what's my performance vehicle going to be? Like, how am I going to share myself with the world? And I think speaking has been it for a long time. Coaching was it for a while. I've always really enjoyed speaking one-on-one with people and sharing this information and helping them get to where they need to be, whether it's as an agent or as a performance coach who incorporates the science with the coaching practice. And now I think with speaking, I look at it as motivational, but really informational as well. I have to be able to bring research to an audience, but I want to make it super fun, super engaging, sometimes super poignant. I want to make it as impactful as possible, but also be equally responsible with the data available to us in the modern world.
Mm. I love that. So you are an academic and you're a super ferocious reader nerd as well.
I am a super ferocious reader nerd, so watch out. Yeah. Keep your hands off my book, buddy.
You over the head with a book.
A big book, though. This is the thing, is if I was a paperback reader, you have no fear. But as an academic, I could literally kill you with some of the books that I have in my book.
That's right.
Oh, I love that. That's awesome. Funny. I used to work in the philosophy library at Rutgers University, where I went to school, and you could kill people with some of those books too. You can kill them just by having them read them.
Yeah. More than that. Exactly.
Who was it who said every morning I wake up and decide, should I have a cup of coffee or kill myself? Some philosopher, and I was like, wow, I can't get into philosophy. That's just too deep for me. Sorry, can't do that. Yeah. Sorry. I'm just going to ask myself how I want my coffee. That's as tough as it gets for me in the morning. It's been tough stuff, but philosophy library, wow.
That's a great journey, Dan. I have a question. So years ago, I became fascinated with positive psychology, and it was like in 2006, I think, Tal Ben-Shahar, I don't know if you know that name, but he was teaching a course in Harvard, and they released his course on happiness just on the internet way back in the beginning of before we had these big kind of online universities and stuff. And I happened to just see it and download it and watched his whole course. And it was just fascinated me that study on positive psychology and the kind of as a new field. And he talked a lot about the history of psychology, focusing so much on the negative versus, you know, positive psychology, kind of a wellness model. But how has that changed your life as you went through that journey and kind of pursued, you know, whatever the degree is in positive psychology, but more so the information? How have you seen that impact you personally? And just how do you use that information in your day-to-day life? How can folks kind of take that type of information and really actualize it in a day-to-day sense?
Sure. It's a great question. I think I'd respond to it from two perspectives. One would be my own. You know, a lot of what it allowed me to do is understand what was working for me and also understand what wasn't working for me. So to understand that why my going to the gym on a regular basis, why I operated differently when I did that, why I was able to deal with stress differently when I did that, why my emotions were different and better when I did that. So in some cases, I was already doing things like that and explained it to me. There were other opportunities that have come since that have been really beneficial. I don't think I would have taken advantage of necessarily had I not been through that. As I indicated before, I'm a big data guy. Like, I totally appreciate that people are saying that meditation is beneficial to them. But you know what? That doesn't sway me. When I see the data, I'm swayed. And so being in a course like that, where they do bring that hardcore data in that says, we have looked at meditators for the last 10 years, and this is what we see at this age, it's like, okay, all right, this is interesting now. And so let me start to make a practice of this. And when I do, and I say when, because when I get consistent on it before I drop away, which I do sometimes, it's a noticeable difference for me. When I know that I write things down, the things I'm grateful for at the end of the day, it's called the gratitude journal. It's one of the more popular, or I should say better known interventions. When I write three things down at the end of a day in a journal saying what I'm grateful for and why, that if I do that consistently over the course of the month, my level of positive emotion will go up. So understanding the simple things that one can do to raise the levels of positive emotion is key. I think the other one I'd add is about relationships. And a lot of us, at least my students for sure, you know, if you ask them, what do they do when they're stressed out in school? They're like, I run to the library and I bury myself in the corner and don't talk to anybody. Or I run underneath the covers with two pints of Jerry's and I eat them and I don't talk to anybody. Like, they like tuck themselves away. And they're like, look, guys, running away from friends when you're under stress is the equivalent of driving away from the hospital when your appendix is about to burst. Right? What you need to do is actually go to your friends. You need to go to that hospital. And even though it might feel like that's the opposite of what you should do. Like, if I feel like, no, I need to take the time to study, actually understanding what happens to us when we are able to spend that time with friends is something that had a big impact on me. So I make sure that I do that consistently as well. So my habits have either been explained to me or I've changed them because of really terrific research that we're seeing emerging. So that said, being a father has been wonderful in many, many ways, in no small part because I've been able to do what so many people in psychology have been looking forward to doing when they're childless, which is do research on my child, which I have done. And that's been really interesting. I don't know if it's interesting for him, but it's been fascinating for me.
I think that is the definition of parenting, is just experimenting on our child.
You hear that, Jordan?
You're right. Yeah, that's right. That's right, Jordan. You're an N of one. Congratulations. So, you know, my little boy, it's been a fascinating journey. And I'll just tell you a quick story. You know, when he was young, he would never stop moving. I mean, fast and often. And climbing everything, jumping off everything. I was like, this kid is going to bash his head in if I don't put him somewhere where there's a mat or padding. He climbed fences. He climbed the first floor grates in New York on the windows. He everything. So I put him in like a kiddie gymnastics class. And he was thrilled. You know, the first day he said, Dad, you know, it's tomorrow gymnastics day. I said, it's not, buddy. Do you want to be? He was like three at the time. He said, I want to be. Okay. So the next day was gymnastics day. Next day, Dad, it's tomorrow gymnastics day. It's not, kiddo. Do you want to be? I want to be. So we started going consistently. And after about 2 months, they said, look, we can't handle him anymore. Like, he's just, you need to take him somewhere else. So they recommended a place here in New York, Chelsea Piers, which has a boys team. And they said, we don't take him that young. And I was like, please just look at him, please. So they did. And they said, we'll take him. Wow. And Julian got really into gymnastics, like super into gymnastics. So much so that even though he was the youngest kid competing in the state, he did really well his first year. He placed top 10 in the state. That being said, when he fell or if he missed a bonus or if his toes weren't pointed and he lost a few points in the competition, he was inconsolable. Like, we couldn't get to him. We're not allowed to. The coaches had to. But he was, like, crying. And, like, when he finished his routine, he'd cry on the mat. And afterwards, he'd be crying. And, Dad, I couldn't, you know, like, what's wrong? I couldn't get this. And, you know, I was like, this is not good. This is not healthy, man. So what he had is what I assumed was something we call obsessive passion. We've mentioned before. Where, you know, he was so focused on one thing that it was really unhealthy for him. And I'd walk into his room and he'd have a stopwatch on the floor timing himself to see how long he could hold a handstand. Like, he was constant. And I thought, okay, we need to get him involved in other things. Now, the original question was positive psychology. How has it changed your life? We look at studies of passion. The idea of harmonious passion is having multiple things of interest in your life. So we always play catch. I introduced him to Little League. He always loved to sing. We got him involved in musical theater. And it was the next year in gymnastics that anything went wrong, if he missed the bonus, if his toes were unpointed, whatever it might be, he'd come off the mat, he'd be okay. He'd come off the mat and say, I can work on that this week, but I have a ball game tomorrow. Or, yeah, I'm definitely going to work on that. I can get that better, but I can't wait to get to my voice lesson on Monday. Right? So he had multiple pillars. And that was a pretty profound experience for me as a parent, for us as parents, I should say. But also in seeing the effectiveness of positive psychology. By the way, that year is the year that he won New York State Championship. And that he was brought into the Olympic development program. So to see that someone could achieve on a higher level by taking a step back from the, not the intensity, but from the all obsessive nature of something really was fascinating for me. And since then, I mean, he was 8 at the time, he's 10 now. Since then, he continued with Little League and voice and he's actually not, he's not in New York right now because he's in the national tour of Les Mis as Gavroche, the little rebel boy, because he took voice and he loved it.
Wow.
You know?
Cool.
Right. Awesome. And so look, I'm not telling you this just because he's my, well, maybe I am just telling you this because he's my kid. But what I found so fascinating is that it wasn't about the intense focus that so many parents out there put on their kids. So you must do the one thing you're great at and be the best. It was, let's choose some things that you enjoy and let's do them all. Because by doing so, it's like you're building your life on multiple pillars rather than one. And so if that one pillar happens, you get a little crack in it, it doesn't all come tumbling down. So it's a long way of saying to your original question, how has positive psychology impacted my life? In no greater fashion than with my child, seeing how he can live a life both of well-being and of success and excellence. And that's been a really beautiful thing that I never would have really understood had I not gone through this process. Mm.
So fascinating. And how old? He's 10 right now?
He's 10.
And he's already on an Olympic training team?
So he was invited to the Olympic development program for gymnastics when he was 8. And so basically you go to camps that are higher level camps and it's the pathway toward the Olympic team. And then Les Mis came.
So you may be out to Colorado Springs someday then, because we have the Olympic Training Center here. That's one of our big things.
Well, he'll either be there tumbling or he'll be there singing, or who knows what else he's out there doing, you know? It's funny because he's on the road right now, actually, at this very moment, He is training with a gymnastics team in Madison, Wisconsin, because he's there for a week for Les Mis. So he still trains, but he loves to sing and perform. And so, you know, I don't know which way he's going to go.
Right.
I think at this point he's going to want to perform. He loves it so much. But the fact that it's not all or nothing, that's what I think is, and that we can succeed. And the argument could be, well, the argument actually is, and we have some strong support for this, that we can have, I'm not going to say that everyone does, but we can have an equal opportunity to succeed in a very high level by entertaining multiple interests rather than just one. We're less likely to burn out, less likely to feel that incredible stress. We're more likely to basically develop other areas that we can take a step back to and say, yeah, it's cool. I didn't win the competition today. I'm going to work hard this week, but I love that. I'm going to hang out with my friends because they love me and I love them and they don't care. You know, so it's that balance that I think we're getting away from in our culture as parents and as kids. For sure. And it goes almost back to your very first question. All the pressure on kids. Well, why? Because they need to be the best at what? How about doing things that you're really interested in across the board? And don't worry about being a fulfillionaire by the time you're 21. It'll come. Just like Seinfeld talked about. Just like you talked about. It takes a long time to write a joke. You know, nothing great quality happens that quickly.
Right.
Until we understand that, you know? So.
Dan, in terms of being a fulfillionaire.
I know. I've never heard that word. I love it.
Yeah. I was reading an article just yesterday, I think it was in New York Times, about how if people spent like $100 to $200 a month extra on like getting a cleaning service or going out to eat instead of having to do it, it like takes pressure off the family. It was just a study on finances and happiness and different kinds of correlations. Have you done some research on this aspect as well? Because I know I've seen some positive psychology folks talk about like making money up to a certain level makes people happier, but then not past that level, or how they approach money really kind of reflects on their state of well-being. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe some of the research that you know about that in relationship to money?
Sure. So, you know, it's interesting. There are a number of studies out there that talk about the relationships of our finance to our well-being. And when I say well-being, by the way, I mean a richer matrix of well-being than just happiness. Positive emotion is important, of course, it's essential, but also our meaning and our sense of security and safety and relationships. So if you look at someone like Daniel Kahneman's work, the Nobel Prize-winning researcher, professor at Princeton, you know, he will talk about there being a certain number. And back when he did this research, it was, I believe it was $75,000 that one needed to make on average, clearly not here in New York, on average to be able to cover the basics, to know that you're going to be safe, secure, feed your family of 2.3 children, to be able to take a modest but really good vacation every year. And once we move past that number, there's a law of diminishing returns. Every extra hour you work for the extra X amount of dollars, you enjoy those dollars less because they're not as important to you. They're not as fulfilling to you. Now, for a long time, that's what people were sort of saying, okay, clearly you make your 75K or whatever it is, you know, given your location. And beyond that, you're not going to get, it's that diminishing law. Since then, we've seen some studies that say, actually, you know, having a little more money is not a bad thing. Like, you know, people, for some people, it does have a greater effect on their lives. But overall, what we're finding is that, no, when we ignore other essential attributes of well-being so that we can make more money, we actually have less, we have lower levels of well-being, lower levels of fulfillment as we spend that time making that money. Mm. So it's going to be highly individualistic too.
Sure.
You know, I mean, where you live, what you need, what, you know, what your priorities are, so on and so forth. But for the most part, I mean, if you ask the simple question, would you be happy making $1,000,000,000 if you never saw your family? Probably not.
Right.
You know, that's for most of us, not necessarily the case.
Right.
You know, but for some of us, it's fine. I remember it's got to be 30 years. I was young and I remember seeing this. For some reason, it stuck in my head, this bold print portion of a New York Times magazine article about Goldman Sachs and the golden parachute. Right? I had to have been like 11. And the statement was, I never got a chance to see my kids grow up, but now I get to see my grandchildren grow up. And I thought, whoa, that's scary.
That doesn't sound that good.
Was that an advertisement?
Exactly.
Now, what was that?
No. It was part of the article. That's exactly right. You'll never have to see your kids. Now, I imagine for some people, that's a total blessing. They're like, perfect. I hate my children. But for those of us who don't hate their children, right, they're like, oh, that doesn't work so well for me. So again, it depends on what you prioritize. But for the most part, can money buy us love? No.
Right.
Nor can it buy us happiness. You know? Mm-hmm. We have to have the basics. We got to put a roof over our head. We got to feel secure. We got to know that these things are okay. But, you know, I think, again, it goes back to that first question you asked about kids in college. We do a lot of social comparison. So right now, we get a chance to do that more than ever. Like, right. You know, there was a time when if you're, you know, Rockefeller or if you're Andrew Carnegie, it's not like people are switching on, you know, they're looking at their phones and they're like, oh, man, check it out. Andrew Carnegie has a 160-foot yacht. Check it out, he has 16 houses, because that wasn't available then, you know?
Yeah, we didn't even know, really.
Right, that's right. We know he was a rich guy.
Right.
You know? Fantastic. Like, we knew that he just built that concert hall over there, that library over there, and the museum a town over. But, you know, some kind of philanthropic stuff, whether he was bathing himself in vintage Dom Perignon, I don't think he was. But, you know, today, if you are, you're taking a picture of that, and you're posting it for everyone to see. And that's a lot of pressure. You know, so
absolutely.
Yeah.
It seems like in that switchover, like up to whatever the number is, like you say, it's really dependent and it is really personal, but it seems like there's a switch in the opportunity cost. So, you know, below a certain number, you're not secure, you're not safe. So you're stressed, you're more, less happy, but over a certain number, then that opportunity cost really comes into play. Like, what is it costing me? What am I giving up to get this? And, you know, we really have to kind of evaluate and look at those kinds of things, I think, to make an informed decision. Otherwise, you're just on that treadmill and then you're just going for something out there, like we talked about earlier, versus really honoring the journey of where you are and who you're about, you know, and who you want to be.
You're spot on. And, you know, and we do have some, look, there are plenty of studies out there that I don't know about for sure. But one that comes to mind for that is a study that, Barry Schwartz and his colleagues did. I don't know if he was the lead author on it, but Barry Schwartz wrote a wonderful book called The Paradox of Choice. He also has a terrific TED Talk out there. I had him in graduate school, and he's a hilarious, brilliant, and also very practical with his research kind of fellow. And he talks about two types of choosers, right? Maximizers and satisfiers. So maximizers are the people who will only accept the very best, the best quality, the best fit, the lowest prices, the whole thing, right? Satisfiers basically set standards. Like, look, I'm not going to spend more than $75 for this sweater. I want it to be all cotton. It needs to fit well, right? And once you hit all those, you know, once you basically hit those, like, I'm good. I'm going to buy the sweater. Off we go. So here's the study that really applies to what you're talking about is, Schwartz looked at the career decisions of high school seniors, and he found that the people who maximized looked at salary. They looked at the kind of people that you're working with. They looked at everything. They did more comparison. They looked at exponentially more jobs to find the absolute best job for them. Satisfiers looked at fewer jobs. They didn't push nearly as hard. The whole thing, they looked at some important factors then for sure, but it wasn't the same maximizing thing. What's fascinating about this is the outcome, is that the maximizers actually ended up making, on average, for their first jobs out of college, $7,000 more than the satisfiers. But the satisfiers ended up with jobs that were substantially more fulfilling than the maximizers' jobs. So they were much happier in their work, even though they made less money. And so it kind of brings us back to this idea of, how are we making our choices? What are we comparing ourselves to? And are we comparing ourselves to so many other possibilities that we're actually losing enjoyment of the decisions that we do make, the choices that we do make at the end of the game? So really deciding what your parameters are going to be, what is important to you before you even go into it, it can have a pretty profound effect on whether you enjoy and how much you enjoy your decisions at the end, be it a sweater or job.
Wow.
Love that. Wow. Fascinating. Dan, before we finish, we definitely want to ask you about your book, You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and in Life, and especially for Cody's daughter.
I need all the answers on that. Like,
we got to get her into college.
all the way from choosing the right college to being happy in college. That's my just answer that right there.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. The original title of this book was going to be Youth Rap, How to Succeed in College and Life, especially if you're Jordan and you're going to school in 2 years.
Oh, too man.
Big to fit on the cover. I'm sorry. I'll write it on there in Sharpie. How's that? And then you're like, no. And I'll explain it inside. That way she'll know it was really meant for her the whole time.
Yeah, can you tell us a bit about the book?
Sure. I mean, it emerged from the course that Alan and I have been teaching for the last 6 years together. And we really thought, you know, we've grown from when I first joined him, he had about 150 students. To now, as I mentioned, but we have about 1,000 a year. And we thought, you know what, we love helping these students. We're really fortunate to do so. And there's a limit to what you can do here in a classroom. We've looked at the only larger classroom at NYU that holds about 900. And we're like, nope, we're not doing it. How do we reach the rest of the folks out there? And so we were really fortunate in being able to have the opportunity to write this book. So it's based on our course, Science of Happiness. And it really does take a look at both the challenges to well-being and thriving on campus, specifically for 18 to 24-year-olds, and also the opportunities to thrive on campus for 18 to 24-year-olds. Now, while a lot of the data goes well beyond 18 to 24, we really wanted to write it in a way that 18 to 24-year-olds would hear it. You know, we can get up there and talk about lawyers and doctors and bankers and depression and, you know, and heart attacks for 80-year-olds. But you know what? College students, they don't care because they're not 80 years old. They're not lawyers or doctors. What right. They really want to know about is what's going on for them right now. And so that's what we do in the classroom. That's what we do in the book. You know, we have 10 teaching assistants due to the size of the course. And the one thing I've always required of them is that they give us feedback, not good feedback, but challenging critical feedback, on what they, as 23, 24-year-olds, is what's reading to them and what's not reading to them. So if it's not reading to them and the students, we will change it. And we do that in the book as well. The science is all rooted in strong empirical work, but the stories that we really, in which they're embedded, are about college students. They're about, for the most part, they're about students we've had. They're about students that we've engaged with one-to-one or as a group. They're about stories we've heard from college students. So we're able to give both examples that they'll relate to and also really give them the strong sign. At the end of each chapter, there are three exercises. And all the exercises, many of them we find already in the classroom. But for positive emotions, it might be the gratitude journal. We'll have a whole set of others for willpower. We'll have a whole set of others for choice. Have a whole set of others for stress. So it gives them the opportunity to understand it and also to really take some action and see how they can make changes themselves. Now, the end life bit is, I think, essential. We say to our students, this should really help you. We're striving to help you in college, but these are the habits we're hoping you develop for the rest of your life. And as I mentioned before, a lot of the research is done on college students, but a lot of the research is done for folks who have graduated from college. So if people are curious for their kids, it's perfect. If they're curious themselves, it's just as applicable. So yeah, we're proud of it. And I think what we really feel proudest of is that, and we get a lot of emails and stuff from folks who have read it, what we're really proudest of and most heartened by is the knowledge that we're helping people get better lives.
And what does Jordan need to know, Dan, when she's choosing college?
Her dad is always right.
Hear that,
but,
girl?
But heading off to college,
Jordan,
though,
you hear that?
what are some tips to, you know, starting college, and especially in that first year? It seems like that freshman year is kind of a trying time, and that's the point maybe where many people don't make it because of the challenge or what have you. So, what are the primary tips like going into college that you would give someone?
So let me take a step back and give her some tips before she even goes. And this is not just to you, Jordan, with all due respect. It's for everyone out there who's thinking about college or have kids who's thinking about college. Think about the qualities of a school that you want rather than just the name of the school itself. Do you want a big school? Do you want a small school? Do you want an urban school? Do you want a rural school? Do you want a school that gives you the opportunity to play a sport or to host a radio show or to write for the paper or to do all three? You know, basically saying you're going to go to a big school and focus on one thing. You're going to go to a small school and explore lots of different things. It's those qualities rather than just the name itself that I think is going to set you up to potentially have a wonderful college experience, right? Rather than look where I'm going and the name on my sweatshirt is in big crimson and white or big whatever it might be. It's no, this is a school that I I've already gotten a sense of what is going to allow me to thrive in this environment. I think setting oneself up like that is really essential. Now, when you actually get to campus, the number one factor is the quality of the relationships for 99% of people. So get involved is what I'd say. Join a group, join a club, join a team, make friends, get to know a professor, get to know a mentor, whatever it might be, because once you do that, you have the social circle, and that's key. It allows you, and I'm not just saying that from a, you're going to be stressed out, so you're going to need these folks to lean on, but it's also a, hey, you're going to have great things, and you're going to want people to share it with. That's a bigger factor than people usually understand. Have the ability to share something with a friend enhances that win, enhances that good grade, enhances that newfound relationship that you enjoy. So you can really make the most of things. So that would be absolutely number one. Meet people, make friends, get involved in groups and clubs, and plant the seeds for wonderful social experience. Yes, grades are important. But again, you're more likely to be thriving in that regard if you have the foundational aspects of relationships. That'd be number one. Number two, I would say, would be to do something, to pursue those things that are of greatest interest to you. Like the pressure of, I must find that thing that I will be great in. I must immediately be in pre-med, even though I don't know why. I must think about being a lawyer, even though I'm only 18. I think that's a road that can be really challenging and leads a lot of college students to have less than optimal experiences. You're in college. Take a course in something you're interested in for no other reason than because you're interested in it. And know that it might lead you nowhere other than the idea that I just explored French. Maybe not for me, but at least I did it. I think that's key. When we look at the development of passion in human beings, again, Valorand at Montreal, University of Montreal, has found it takes on average 3 years. It takes on average 3 years to develop a passion. And they start with interest. They're not thunderbolt moments. Not like, boom, I was 6 years old. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer, because no 6 year old actually wanted to be a lawyer. You know, like, man, I was 9 years old. I knew I was going to. Like, sometimes they do. I saw my first guitar. I knew I wanted to be a guitarist. But overwhelmingly, they start with things that we're interested in. And we're like, yeah, I'm going to check that out. I had a student who came to us a couple years ago who I hadn't known. She took our course freshman year. She was a senior at this point, and she said, yeah, I was in your class. I was a theater major, and I just needed a science. I just needed something to get it on my transcript. And I thought psychology was actually really interesting when I took it with you guys. So I decided to take another class in psychology the next semester. And then the next year, I took another class. And then I took another class. And then I changed my major because it really was fascinating to me. She said, now I'm graduating, and I'm going to grad school in psych, and I'm super excited about it. It's not what I would have expected when I kicked it off. So I think that's the other thing, is to really just get involved in things that you find interesting and just enjoy that journey, and don't worry about, right? Yes, don't worry about the outcome.
I love that. Great advice.
Yeah.
Great advice. Like, thanks, Dan. I think we are about out of time for today, but man, you just have so much to share, Dan, and your enthusiasm is contagious.
Definitely.
Super contagious.
Covered a lot of ground. You're catching it right now? Is that... You know, something's contagious we do want, and some things are contagious we don't want.
We don't want. Yeah.
Right. So hopefully today's enthusiasm is one that you did. and you're welcome.
Yeah.
No, you know, it's funny. I would say, look, a great interview, a great podcast is at least 50% the interviewer. And in this case, let's be generous, and let's just say that each of us is responsible for 33.3% of the greatness of this podcast. So I am definitely not responsible for the majority of it. You guys, you know, it's you guys. Thank you.
You are a true academic.
True numbers guy. Yeah. So,
for all of you listening out there, make sure you don't get hit over the head with the big textbook, and also do what you love, be passionate. Happiness before success will lead to success. And to find Dan, let's see, we've got danlerner.com, which is your website, and You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and in Life for Cody's Daughter and everyone else on the planet. Dan, thank you so much for being here, and We'll talk again soon. Yeah. Have an awesome trip. We know you're headed out to do some public speaking and be well, my friend.
Thank you so much.
Guys, thank you so much. Have a wonderful day. I really appreciate the time.
You too, my friend. You too. Take care. Thanks everyone for listening.
You too.
See you next time.
Hey, everybody, that was Dan Lerner. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I must say, this is the first episode where I have gotten specific and direct advice for my daughter. Right? And that was kind of interesting. And it was, nice and playful of Dan to really kind of speak to Jordan and her needs. And really, the needs of so many of us of how to kind of approach life in a way that where we can succeed, right? And pursue not only success, but happiness, and where those two intersect is not necessarily where we think, right? What we think might make us happy is not necessarily what the studies and science proves out. And when we can really both pursue a fulfilling, successful career or hobby or existence, and kind of be knowledgeable about those things that create deep meaning and happiness for us, and kind of bring those together, it's like everything works. So yeah. I had a fun time getting to chat with him.
Dan made the mistake of inviting us to his class at NYU.
He did.
And he did.
I told Jordan and she said, "We're going." I said, "All right."
I'm that nerdy kid who sits in the front row and constantly raises his hand and asks questions. Yeah, that'd be great to go sit in on one of those classes and see what it's like.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dan Lerner was really cool. He's a really smart dude. He definitely has a intellectual grasp of all the scientific research around happiness that I think you or I we definitely don't have it. Our interest, I think, has always been more in the practical side of meditation and teaching and doing the work. But it is great to validate it from the scientific perspective and have that piece. Because I know when I go teach at like corporations or at a university, people like to have that part of the work validated, so they know it's not just a bunch of woo-woo.
Right.
Even though it is a bunch of woo-woo, but it's still good. No,
it's but just it's nice to know how it works and what really kind of happens. I like the studies that really look at the physiology of what happens in the human body and the brain as you meditate or shift your awareness, and the fact that something happens is always very validating to see.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah. So thank you all for being on the woo-woo train with us.
So, and you can find Dan Lerner really easily online at daniellerner.com, and you can see about, all of his work and his books and read about him and start to follow him.
Awesome guest. Thanks for being here, Dan. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And we will see you next time on Energy Matters. Enjoy yourselves, guys.
See you, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to the Energy Matters podcast with Cody Edner and David Gandelman. Brought to you by intuitivevision.net and groundedmind.com. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or soundcloud.com.